Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. The deadly bombings at the Boston Marathon and security concerns about the upcoming Winter Olympics in Russia have a common link: the North Caucasus. This rugged region between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea is beset by a violent Islamic insurgency. The two brothers suspected of setting off the bombs in Boston are ethnic Chechens with ties to neighboring Dagestan, an even more volatile semi-autonomous republic. And the 2014 Olympics are being held in the resort city of Sochi on the Black Sea, close to the Caucasus. Earlier this month, both the director of America's FBI and the prime minister of Britain visited Sochi to discuss security at the Olympic Games. Today, we'll dig into the roots of terrorism in the North Caucasus and the strong presence of Islamic militants fighting Moscow's rule. During a second segment, we'll discuss a free press subject: the proposed SHIELD law to protect U.S. reporters. Our guest will be the president of the Society of Professional Journalists. Our first guests are from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. Alexei Malashenko is co-chair of the Carnegie Moscow Center's Religion, Society, and Security Program. And Tomas Duval is a former broadcast journalist who now specializes in the Black Sea region. Welcome and thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Great.
Invitation.
Thank you. And just in general, to start off, why have the Caucasus been so unstable?
Well, I can start, but I think that it began approximately 25 years ago on the eve of the collapse of the Soviet Union and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it derives from political, social, economic problem because Caucasus, I mean Russian Caucasus, it's a weak point from the all points of view, yes?
Right.
Situation, the economic and social situation is all the time much worse than in Moscow, in other Russian regions, first. Second, the presence, activity of Islamic opposition. And Islamic opposition in the 90s, it was supported by from abroad, from Persian Gulf, from Middle East, and indeed it was a war. It was a war between Islamic opposition and administrations, well, power, and so on. And the last point, I mean, two Chechen wars that led to total destabilization, not in Chechnya only, but in the region, in particular in Dagestan, in Ingushetia. Just to summarize, I want to emphasize one very important thing. Sometimes some experts are blaming Chechens on Islamic opposition, and maybe that's true, but the roots of a constant conflict, a constant destabilization in the region derives from the mistakes made by Moscow, by federal center. First of all, by Sam Yeltsin, by his team, and then it was repeated by Putin. So as to me, I don't see any positive issue in a couple of years, well, some next morning. So I think that we'll talk and we'll discuss the problem of Northern Caucasus a lot of times right. In the future.
And Tom, you covered this area in the 90s. How was it back then compared to what it is now, as far as its stability?
Well, I mean, it was the first Chechen war, which I covered, was a horrible conflict in which basically a political dispute between a pro-independence leader in Chechnya and Boris Yeltsin in Moscow got out of control and ended up with this massive, you know, almost Second World War-type destruction of Chechnya. And you could see, the great tragedy of this was that you could see the bonds between Russians and Chechens, who'd after all been living in the same state for the generations, being broken apart by this destruction. You could see the radicalization of the young generation. And now the 20-somethings, who are now the Islamic radicals in this region were just being born then. The older generation still feel, you know, that they were part of the Soviet Union. They're still more secular. It's the younger people who are much more radicalized. And I saw the beginning of that process back in the 1990s.
And Alexei, how has that progressed?
Well, I think that Islam continued to stay one of the main political factors. And I totally agree with Tom when he says about new generation. Look, because at the moment, Russian government, Putin, ruling class, they deal with non-Soviet people in Caucasus, non-Soviet young generation. And it's very important because they have no Soviet experience. They have no, I would say, a future, because there is a jobless, there are economic and social problem. And in that case, in that situation, more and more of young generations, then they begin to think, to be involved in a so-called Islamic alternative. They want to come back to Caucasian tradition, to Islamic tradition. And it's normal, because if we look at what we have in Northern Caucasus, first of all, we observe that Russian federal laws, Russian constitution doesn't work. Russian economic programs and social programs failed. So to which side have people, in particular young generation, will turn? To Islam, it's normal. And first of all, it concerns the situation in Dagestan, in Ingushetia, and more or less in Chechnya. So sometimes we call Northern Caucasus, a Russian Northern Caucasus, I emphasize it, an inner abroad, a foreign abroad. Right. So it's a very abnormal situation.
Right. Different religion, different geography, history.
And different civil values.
Right. And Tom, in Dagestan particularly, there have been a great deal of bombings in recent months. Just one on Monday killed four people and injured 44. There were two car bombs in the capital of the Dagestan. Tell us about what's happening there as far as the bombings.
What we're seeing is it's now Dagestan is now the most violent part of that region. It used to be Chechnya. It's now Dagestan. About 700 people a year are dying, of whom more than half, I think, are the casualties are in Dagestan. And I think it's a particularly intractable problem, because you've got a struggle for political power. There are 14, would you believe it, main ethnic groups in Dagestan. You've got a criminal element there with struggles over business and money. And then you've got the Islamic element on top of that, with young men being picked up and harassed and going to the hills and picking up guns and fighting. So with all of those elements together, this problem is not really soluble. It's very much a matter of keeping a lid on it getting any worse than about solving anything in the short term.
Right. And if you look at a map of this region and look at where the Olympics is being held on the Black Sea, they're very close. Could you just kind of describe that geography of this region between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea?
Well, we talk about the Caucasus, and that's the mountains, the highest mountains in Europe, and stretching from up on the Black Sea, on the sort of north west, where Sochi is, where the Olympics is, and then down to Dagestan, which is on the Caspian Sea, southeast of there. So, a few hundred miles of mountains, multiple ethnic groups. And it's true, this big international event, the Winter Olympics, is going to be held right in this region, which is the most violent region of Europe.
Given what happened in Boston, how are the Russian officials preparing for the Sochi Olympics?
Well, I think that the place, the city for Olympic Games was chosen when it was chosen by Putin. He did a big mistake, because indeed it's very dangerous, and not only because it's very close to Caucasus. Look, I can admit that penetration of some radicals or some extremists or bombists could be made not from Caucasus itself directly, but from Russia. I think that's extremely, extremely difficult to make some obstacles on their way. So we have to be ready of all kind of incidents. I think in Russia, in Moscow, finally they begin to understand the situation and they attempt to do their best. And there are two directions. One direction is to do something in Caucasus itself, or to negotiate, or to strengthen the stability. But the problem of city, of Sochi itself, it's very difficult. Of course, they attempt to make some measures, but if indeed there are some terrorist groups, some extremists who dreams to penetrate inside Sochi, I think that they can do it. And don't forget one more thing, a so-called international radical Islamism, because some of those who work in Chechnya, I mean terrorists, they can get assistance from abroad. So the situation is totally unpredictable. And if nothing happens, it will be a great success of Putin. If he fails and if we see in Sochi some incidents, that will be tragedy not only for Sochi, for Olympic Games, but for Russia.
Right. And Tom, are we already seeing attempts to crack down on militants or suspected terrorists?
Well, yeah, we see an ongoing crackdown across the whole region, and we're also seeing what you might call rather old-fashioned, heavy-handed Russian security tactics. I heard about a downhill ski race, which was held in Sochi about a year ago, mm-hmm. in which there were actually more soldiers lining the route than watchers. And I think this is going to be the big dilemma for the Russians. They want to kind of blanket the games with security, and yet they also want to have a normal games in which people can wander about and watch the events. And it's going to be a complete nightmare for them to try and sort out their priorities then.
And is there a blowback from this crackdown?
I mean, as I said just a moment ago, about 700 people a year are dying in violence across the North Caucasus. So yeah, it's by any standards, this is a low intensity war going on there.
What do you see, Alexei? What would you recommend? You said that the negotiations, what are some other activities that could happen that have a positive effect on security?
When you pronounce the notion, the word of negotiation, finally, to my mind, it means to negotiate with certain Islamic opposition, certain elements of Islamic opposition. It's necessary, and I do believe that such negotiations have taken place, yes. But don't forget that there is a big gap between different group of Islamic extremism. And to my mind, maybe federal administration even is able to pay to some field commanders in order to avoid their extremist activity. It's possible. But in general, the landscape, political and religious, the landscape in Caucasus is very difficult and very dangerous and provocative for these games. Don't forget that in Dagestan, at the moment, we have practically a civil war because every day somebody is killed, murdered, and practically each 2 weeks, each month, we have, I would say, a terrorist act in the region, in Dagestan or in Ingushetia.
Okay. And Tom, can you touch on the second issue with the local Circassian population?
Yeah, this is yet another element. Is we have to remember that there's a long history of warfare in this region. It was, I think, the longest war of the 19th century was between the Russian Empire and these Muslim peoples of the North Caucasus. And the people on the west side around Sochi were the Circassian people. Some of them are still left, but most of them were deported in horrible circumstances in the year 1864 across the Black Sea. Tens of thousands of them died. And by bad coincidence, 2014 is the 150th anniversary of that deportation. So there are a lot of Circassian people who are saying, wait a minute, you're holding an Olympic Games, are holding a celebration on the spot where you committed genocide against us. And so that's yet another issue that the Russian government has to deal with. And I think they should probably be taking a leaf out of the book of the Canadians in Vancouver who honored the indigenous native peoples of Canada in those games. But they've woken up to that issue rather late, and that there could be protests by Circassians at the Olympics.
Okay. We've been talking with Alexei Malashenko and Tomas Duval from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks again for joining the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Bye. On Wednesday, a group of Democrats and Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives advocated for a shield law to protect the press from unwarranted spying. On the line now from Little Rock, Arkansas, is Sonny Alvarado, president of the Society of Professional Journalists, or SPJ. Welcome.
Hey, how are you this morning?
Well, thank you. Now, the federal shield law, formerly called the Free Flow of Information Act, protects journalists from having to reveal their sources and documents. So Sonny, please talk about the two recent cases that is causing what you call a resurrection of this proposal in Congress.
Sure. The first case that we became aware of was a couple of weeks ago now. The Justice Department informed the Associated Press that the Justice Department had obtained telephone records for 20 different telephone lines belonging to AP and its reporters, both personal and business lines, in three locations, Hartford, Connecticut, Washington, D.C., and New York City. Apparently, the...
What were they fishing for?
They were fishing for, apparently, they did not, the Justice Department didn't specifically say, but based on circumstantial and contextual evidence, it appears they were looking for contacts between AP reporters and potential sources of leaks of classified information.
Okay.
Specifically, AP had published in 2012 a story about a successful clandestine operation in which a terrorist plot in Yemen had been foiled and relied on, obviously, confidential sources to get that story. The timing of the information that the Justice Department sought, May and April of last year, indicates that, you know, that's about the time that that story was published.
Okay. And the second case involving Fox News reporter James Rosen.
Yeah, in that one, the Justice Department apparently not only got phone records, they actually observed him and, you know, basically spied on him and using his the swipe of his magnetic pass key in and out of the particular federal office building in which they suspected there was a leak.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really, in his case, it's really egregious. And the thing that's most disturbing is that in court documents, they refer to him as a as an aider, abettor, or co-conspirator, basically accusing, without actually charging him with a crime, basically accusing the reporter of acting in a criminal fashion.
Right. And, you know, I guess their arguments would be that they're trying to protect the country. But what's dangerous about this for democracy?
Well, what's dangerous about it is, first of all, you know, reporters' jobs... the job of a reporter is to find out stuff that the government doesn't necessarily want you to know about. Now, obviously, there are legitimate reasons for having state secrets, classified information. The difficulty comes when reporters become the source for the government to pursue what they classify as a crime, the leaking of classified information. Reporter's job, you know, it's not illegal for a reporter to seek out information. It's illegal for somebody to leak it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the reporter then becomes a tool of the law enforcement arm of the law, and, of the government. And, mm-hmm. you know, except in extremely rare circumstances, journalists should not be coerced into being an arm of the law, basically.
Right. And many states have a shield law, so why is this federal law so important for media advocates?
Yeah, the benefits of a shield law go beyond the national security, the high profile national security cases that these latest incidents are examples of. The vast majority of subpoenas are issued in civil cases and in criminal cases that don't involve classified information. Since 2001, five journalists have been sentenced or jailed for refusing to reveal their confidential sources in federal court. Two of those journalists were sentenced to 18 months in prison, and another one faced up to $5,000 a day in fines, which he had to pay himself. He was not able to be reimbursed by his employer or family or friends. So the issuance of subpoenas at the federal level for journalists to reveal confidential information sources is a much greater problem than a lot of people realize. And the importance to democracy is that the American public relies on the independent voice of journalists to tell them what their government is up to.
What would these, there are two separate bills in the House and Senate, what would they do to create the free flow of information?
Well, first of all, in the House bill, the House bill would protect a person engaged in journalism, whether or not there's any promise of confidentiality from a source, and whether or not the information would identify a source. Basically, it's a very broad bill. It covers both confidential and non-confidential information, whether or not the information would identify a source. The Senate bill is a bit narrower. It basically describes protected information as information identifying a source who provided information under a promise of agreement of confidentiality. Basically, the Senate bill does not protect non-confidential information, and it does not protect information that would not identify a source. Basically, it's very specific. Only protecting a journalist in a case where the information that the court is trying to force the journalist to reveal would specifically identify an individual.
Right. And you've written a similar legislation, won House approval twice in 2009 and 2010, and won committee approval in the Senate in 2009. And the administration really didn't push for this until after the AP scandal. Do you think that the chances are better now?
I think the chances are marginally better. I think if all of the organizations and individuals who supported the legislation in 2009-2010 act quickly and in a concerted way to get a bill finally through the Senate, I think the Senate is the key. I think the House will again approve a bill. But getting it through the Senate will be the tougher one, and I think the timing is good for it to happen. If the momentum is lost or something else happens that basically turns the tide of public opinion and the opinions of the senators against journalists again, it probably won't make it. If it does get through the Senate, the president has said he would sign it.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that since he ran for office. In fact, in the run-up to the passage debate on the bill in the committee in 2009, I think that's correct. In 2009, the president, the administration, basically balked at some of the provisions, and there were a lot of heated negotiations to get the bill back in the shape that the administration could support. And I think the president of SBJ at the time wrote an editorial basically blasting the president for backing off of his support of the bill at that time.
Right. And Obama is becoming notorious for cracking down on leaks and attempting to punish journalists. Is that correct?
That's how I interpret it. You know, first of all, yes, it's a fact that he's become notorious for cracking down on leaks. This administration has prosecuted more leaks than any other previous administration since the enactment of the 1917 Espionage Act, which a lot of the prosecutions are based on. I believe the administration actively is trying to punish journalists for doing their jobs. That's my opinion.
All right. And what is SBJ asking members of the media to do to influence the debate?
We're asking journalists to write letters, call their senators and congressmen, specifically senators. We're going to ask newspapers and TV stations that have editorials and radio stations that have editorials to editorialize in favor of the legislation, and at least in favor of passage of a shield law. It's anyone's guess at this point whether or not the bills that were introduced, even though they're very similar to bills that have already received approval at some level, will be the bills that actually end up becoming legislation if that happens.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We've been speaking with Sonny Alvarado, president of the Society of Professional Journalists.
Thank you.
Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Stay with us for a free press watch, and please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Global Journalist's free press watch. This week's news concerning media freedom comes out of Uganda, Israel, Iran, and India. In Uganda, police took over the offices of two newspapers after their reports about the presidency. The buildings where the Red Pepper and the Daily Monitor are published were reportedly placed on lockdown, with no one allowed to leave or enter. Out of the Middle East, the Washington Post reports that governments in Israel and the Palestinian territories are preventing journalists from gaining free access to both areas and, as a result, restricting full coverage. According to the Post, reporters who cooperate with peers from across the borders are typically labeled collaborators and have much of their work taken and their social media accounts affected. Palestinian authorities have started requiring Israeli journalists to apply for credentials, and anyone without them will be escorted away by police. Israeli authorities have restricted the movement of more than 1,000 Palestinian journalists into the Israeli-occupied sector of the West Bank and Jerusalem. Upcoming elections in Iran have initiated a serious chill on the press by government authorities around the nation, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Two leading candidates were refused a place on the Iranian ballot. In addition to this, news of the election has traveled slowly to the citizens of Iran due to slower internet connections, blocked websites, and some political journalists being called back to prison after their release. Over to India, unidentified assailants stabbed three daily newspaper staff members to death while they were working in their office in Bengali. NDTV reports that the proofreader, office driver, and office manager died before reaching the hospital. Police have begun an investigation, but according to Reporters Without Borders, the head of the governing party of Tripura State has not yet condemned the attack. For more information about these events and others involving independence of the press around the world, visit our website, globaljournalist.org.